Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Rebecca Berry, and we are going to be talking about Doomsday Book by Connie Willis, which was the 1993 co-winner of the Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Rebecca, thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Seth.
Yes, thank you for reaching out. This is another contact form success story. So I'm always thrilled when anybody not directly related to me finds the podcast. So tell my listeners about yourself.
Well, you know, the first question you had asked me is if people might know me from anywhere. And the answer is no, Seth. I am a high school teacher and I have been for the past 7 years, but I haven't really done anything to manifest my interest in science fiction literature up to this point. And so I'm just getting started. And here's hoping that this kicks off a wonderful time for me.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, by the way, for making it available to people like me who can simply contact you and ask about things like this. I will strive to bring the conversation up to your usual standard.
No, it's my pleasure. You know, I have a lot of guests who are other podcasters, but it's definitely not limited to that.
Yeah. So a little bit about me. I grew up in the Chicago suburbs, went to school in Minnesota. I taught in Shanghai for a year, 2 years in Brussels. And for the past years, I've been teaching in Groton, Connecticut, which is where I am calling from today. And my story kind of reminds me of a line from David Mitchell's The Bone Clocks. He says that rootlessness is the 21st century norm. And I think that might be the case for a lot of people of my generation at this point,
sure,
is that every 3 or 4 years, we sort of uproot, find somewhere else to go. And it's been a very educational, gratifying experience for me. Cool. So I'm keeping my options open. Teaching is my passion. It is central to my heart. But, you know, I'd love to be able to express my interest and passion for science fiction and speculative fiction in the future in creative writing, scholarly writing, podcasting, anything to do with literary analysis. And I also have interest in theater, journalism. And to me, what something is so exciting about science fiction is that its future is interdisciplinary and multimodal. In particular, I've become very interested in works produced in the field of Afrofuturism, and that encapsulates so well the idea that speculative futurity can be expressed not just in written word, but in performance, fashion, music, art, film, documentary, activism, just all planes of human creation. And I think in the 21st century, that is what's going to be the saving grace for science fiction and related fields, is that it is naturally adaptable to the things that we see changing in the world.
Yeah. Well, I can just say right now, I think I'm going to have a hard time keeping up with you. So you sound like the seasoned podcaster.
Not at all.
It's funny. My the episode that'll go up before this one, if I ever get it edited, is a Comfort Reads episode that I'm doing with my sister. And she actually taught in Shanghai as well, and Changchun.
So, very nice.
Yeah. She just got back. I mean, she got back right as everything was kicking off with the coronavirus. So,
oh, good timing.
Yeah. Well, she actually had to go back after the first wave in China, and now she's back for good. So,
and that will not be the last time we bring up the coronavirus in this conversation,
no,
because this is an interesting time capsule of a read.
It is. Yeah. Yes. You talked about some of your history and the fact that you are a science fiction fan, but where does that fandom come from? Is it a TV, movie, books, everything?
Yeah. I grew up in a household that celebrated both Star Wars and Star Trek.
Yes, nice.
One of my pieces of nerd cred is that my parents' first date back in high school was to go see the first Star Trek movie in theaters.
Oh, very nice.
But when I knew that science fiction was important to me came at a swim meet in ninth grade. My mother handed me Ilium by Dan Simmons and said, hey, this made some national bestseller lists. Read this. And I spent the next 7 or 8 hours at the very boring swim meet.
believe me,
reading about the Iliad taking place on Mars and a man on future Earth getting eaten by a T-Rex and resurrected immediately afterwards. And it was so unlike anything I had read and yet so engaging. I sort of let that sit by itself for a couple years. And then as a freshman in college, I tried to track it down again. And Ilium wasn't in my college's library, but they did have Dan Simmons' Hyperion, which I know is very high in your list, which makes me very happy.
Yeah,
I took Hyperion to breakfast with me and I sat down And when I next looked up, 2 hours had passed and had finished Father Paul Jury's story. And I just knew that something in my life had changed. It was like a door was opening. And ever since then, I've gotten really into David Mitchell. Just this past year, I was exposed to Octavia Butler and Samuel Delaney, and that opens a whole new door to amazing works. And I guess sort of the last thing I'm thinking about with this is I had a recent conversation with one of my old professors where she said that she's worried that classic works of literature are sort of falling by the wayside. Nobody reads Chaucer and John Donne. And I said, but you have to understand, science fiction incorporates all the classics. Because of what I read in science fiction, I went and picked up the Iliad. Because of David Mitchell, I picked up Solzhenitsyn. Because of Delaney, I picked up Oscar Wilde. And so I see that as a really hopeful, optimistic outlook on the future, that so much of sci-fi is allowed to build on the history of human thought and knowledge, and that it will always draw upon those things. And hopefully, you know, it's like science fiction is a gateway drug to reading more literature. And that's one of my favorite things about it.
Totally agree. I love the idea of science fiction as a gateway to other literature. And as a teacher, right, you have a unique opportunity to kind of to make that happen.
Yeah, I've had the great pleasure of teaching The Giver, Brave New World, and Fahrenheit 451, and had great experiences with all of them. And in fact, I think the Fahrenheit one was the first podcast episode of yours that I listened to.
Oh, nice.
And that was at the beginning of quarantine last year. And it was just a breath of fresh air. I felt like I'd listened to so many things that were critiques and deconstructions. And this was just a celebration of literature. And so thank you for making that available to us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I like about the podcast is normally, well, it depends. Sometimes somebody will be like, I've been wanting to read this book. And so maybe we're both reading it for the first time. And so I don't know if either of us is going to like it. But lots of times it's somebody who's picking one that they really, really love. And so there's always at least kind of that side of it. There's times where something that somebody else really loves, I'm kind of like, it didn't totally work for me. But we do try and keep it as positive as possible.
Yeah.
So did you happen to tally up how many of the Hugo winners that you've read?
I have currently read 13 of the Hugo winners. I've got 8 more sitting on my shelves waiting to be read.
Oh, nice. And I may have episodes to go with it. And if I don't, then Hugo Girl may have those episodes, or the Hugo and Nebula Readership podcast, which are two sort of sister podcasts of mine.
Well, we'll check it out.
So why did you choose Doomsday Book?
I had never read it before, but it came recommended by my dear friend and colleague, Kelly Donovan, as one that she really loved. And she's a big Connie Willis fan. And the other reason this book stood out to me is because my husband is a medievalist. And bless his heart, he has faithfully, tirelessly attempted to inculcate in me a love for medieval literature. And I have to say, as a teacher, I am disappointed with how bad of a student I am in this realm of literature. So I wanted to challenge myself to understand more.
The shoe is on the other foot.
Yes.
Cool. So can you give, this is one of those books where there are some things in it that you might consider spoilers, but since they happen so early in the book, I feel like we can talk about them. But then there's a couple other things that I feel like are beyond the pale in terms of trying to stay as non-spoiler as possible. But can you try for a non-spoiler synopsis of the book?
I have prepared one, and the way I got around the spoilers issue is by making it sound like a movie trailer. So here goes.
Oh, here we go.
All right. In the year 2055, a group of Oxford historians plans to undertake what they assume will be a relatively low-risk time travel venture, sending a first-year apprentice named Kivrin, who studied Latin and Middle English as well as medieval history, to a few weeks in a small town around Christmas time in 1320 to record her observations and report back. As in all good time travel stories, absolutely nothing goes as planned, and unexpected challenges ensue on Kivrin's end and the team of Oxford employees she left behind.
Very nice.
Thanks. I hope I didn't give too much away.
Yeah. What was that guy's name? LaFontaine, Don LaFontaine, the inner world guy. Yeah. That's what I was thinking of. Yeah, this is this is another entrance in the Oxford time travel series by Connie Willis.
Yeah.
I have not read all of them. I have previously read To Say Nothing of the Dog. And so kind of by way of recommending it to people, you know, if you're fans of that novel, this one will probably work for you, though. Have you read To Say Nothing of the Dog?
No. Was it strange reading it before this one?
No, not really. They're Dunworthy and Finch are in both books. Maybe a couple of other characters, but there's not much. I don't remember any explicit mentions of the events of this book, even though To Say Nothing of the Dog comes later. Tonally, they're quite different. To Say Nothing of the Dog is very funny. If you read any other Connie Willis, like Bellwether or some of her other stuff, she writes humor very, very well. And that one's, a lot of fun.
Oh, that's very intriguing.
But can you think of other comps?
I had a couple of thoughts of what kind of people might like this book. Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of Mary Doria Russell's The Sparrow and the sequel, Children of God. This doesn't involve any space travel, but it does have questions of faith, personal belief in the face of the universe's seeming apathy towards suffering and injustice and the quest to reclaim it. I was thinking that since this is sort of pandemic themed, if people are into the idea of books that speak to current social conditions, they might be interested in Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower and Parable of the Talents, which feature California fires and societal breakdown.
Yeah.
So she set the book in 2021 and it features a politician who uses the phrase, make America great again. She is prophetic.
Wow.
It's unbelievable. And the other book that this sort of reminds me of is Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula Le Guin, in that the setup seems to be primarily about political intrigue and maybe sort of like, almost a Shakespearean version of like family drama mixed with culture clash. Yeah. And then it does sort of a bait and switch or subverts that formula and turns into more about survival and more about forming alliances and sort of examining the breakdown of society rather than the inner workings of it.
Right. Yeah, I think those are both. I haven't read Parable of the Sower yet. I need to do that. I'm remiss in not having read that one yet.
I would recommend. It's timely.
Yeah. I'll definitely check that one out. I also thought of Timeline by Michael Crichton, which is a much more popular level, not as literary as Doomsday Book, certainly. But it actually attempts to deal with some of the ideas of, in movies, people travel to the 1500s, speaking just regular old English from the 21st or 20th century and communicating with people, no problem. I'm like, that's not how language works.
Yeah. Well, as a language guy, what did you think of the handling of Middle English and Latin and other languages covered by this book?
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of yada yada, right? Because they have the translator chip or whatever it is that they get. But I like that it's at least acknowledged that you couldn't just go back there and communicate with people easily. Down to even the idea of a young woman traveling back there, and would she be literate?
Right.
And so, at some point she's kind of caught reading Latin, and that's an event.
Yes. I really appreciated the implication that when she uses Latin, she's intelligible to the other people who know Latin. But when she uses Middle English, they can't understand her right away, because I think the implication there was the way that scholars interpret it today may not be accurate to the actual pronunciation that would have been used at the time.
I thought
that was a great twist.
Yeah. And and we're into the non-spoiler discussion in case anybody didn't know. I know that there are efforts to find out, how did Shakespeare sound in its day, right? And the way they do that is comparing things that seem to be rhyming that don't rhyme now, right? And that's one thing that they do in order to figure out how were these words pronounced back when Shakespeare actually wrote them. And it's one of those things that's just kind of a little hobby of mine. I'm not exactly a linguistics buff or anything, but I'm fascinated by it. We never really did say overall thoughts on the book.
Overall thoughts on the book. So, if I had a star system, I'd give it like 4 out of 5 stars. I felt overwhelmingly positive toward the book. I do think there are some sections that drag on a little bit long, but I liked the way that it subverted some of my expectations for traditional time travel narrative. And I like a lot of the characters. I find them to be very likable and heartwarming. And I think that for a time travel novel, it doesn't have as much jargon as I was expecting to have to get used to.
Right.
And so that's kind of accessible. And in addition, I think this is a great book for anybody who's really interested in authors who demonstrate their level of research and who's interested in sort of the historical tie-ins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's a different kind of the level of research than you see in something like The Martian that's really hard science fiction.
Yeah.
Because like you said, here and in To Say Nothing of the Dog, they just mention there's the net, and that's how they time travel.
Right.
But it's, the mechanism is never really explained. There's some notion that once they've traveled, then they have a fix, like a space-time fix that they can use to then open it back up to get somebody back, and that's important. But the mechanism of it is not important to the reader. And I feel like I saw David Agronoff, who was on my podcast for Waystation and is host of the Philip K. Dickheads podcast. He is also a writer. And he mentioned the other day, I think on Facebook, he said that good world building essentially is treating the reader as if they already know what's going on.
Oh.
And so not just saying, you know, as you know, Jim, that kind of thing, but like introducing a topic and not having to spend two or three pages on exposition explaining it, just being like, I've given you enough of that so that you can kind of figure it out as we go along. And I feel like Connie Willis is really, really good at that.
Yes. Yes.
So, and I agree with you. I was a big fan of this book. Really, really enjoyed it. I think I like To Say Nothing of the Dog better just because it's funny.
Yeah.
I think any other, you know, in 2 years, if I read this one, I might like it even more. Or like 3 years ago, if I read it, I might've liked it even more, but you know, in the age of a pandemic, and the coronavirus, you know, some of it hits a little close to home.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, tonally, it's much more dour. And we'll get into some of that, I think, in spoilers.
Yeah, for sure.
Any other thoughts going into spoilers?
I wanted to give a shout out to the sort of very English Batman-Robin dynamic of Mr. Dunworthy and Colin, the 12-year-old
yes.
grandnephew of Dr. Aaron's. I thought they mm-hmm. were a very adorable pair. And it was very charming following yes. their exploits.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about some of the pronunciation of the names. I was expecting that the book would actually have like a pronunciation guide in it.
Yeah.
And my edition did not have it. But I've been listening to the audiobook just over the last couple of days.
Oh, yeah, you'll have to tell me.
And so like before we started, when you actually, for listeners don't need to know this, but you tried to call me and I had the wrong headphones on because I was listening to the end of the audiobook because I finished reading it yesterday and I just wanted to kind of get the conclusion of it more solidly in my head. And I was at that point on the audiobook as well. I often do that where I'll read in print and listen to the audiobook. And so, yeah, knowing kind of how those names were pronounced was helpful.
Nice.
Right. So spoiler talk, let's do it.
Yeah, let's do it.
This is you know, freeform discussion. Anything that you want to talk about, we can talk about.
Oh, I think I want to start by talking about the ways that this book challenged my expectations for what it was going to be. So it seems inevitable as soon as you find out that Kivrin's going to the past and everybody keeps mentioning the plague, mm-hmm. even though they say that she's not going to be there, that the plague's going to show up at some point. But the first way that Connie sort of flips that on his head is by having Kivrin, the person from the present day, be the one who takes the illness to the past. Oh,
right.
What I really love about that is that they kept placing an emphasis on, oh, people in the 1300s were so backwards medically. They were so ignorant of the things we know today. Right. We're so much cleaner. We're so much more civilized. And of course, people today do not realize just how many germs we carry with us, just how at risk we are of something escalating into a full-blown pandemic.
Yeah, I enjoyed that as well, just because you didn't mention it in the non-spoiler thing, but there are illnesses on both ends of the time travel.
Right.
Back in the past and in the present day, which is our future. But there's discussion of, well, no, she can't take an illness through the net that would affect anybody in the past. And so there's that mystery as to, well, then how did she get through carrying an illness with her? Or is it something she caught as soon as she got there? And the fact that there's an illness breaking out in the present as well is a good mystery. I enjoyed that.
So I wanted to check my knowledge on something and see if this theory holds up with your understanding of the novel as well. Mm-hmm. My understanding, after thinking about how the net operates and the fact that this algorithm does not allow people through if they're going to somehow change the events of history, is that they must have prevented her from arriving in 1320, pushed her all the way to 1348, because they said it doesn't matter if she shows up sick because all these people are going to die anyway. Is that your understanding of how that worked?
That is my understanding.
That is so
as
dark.
Well as the idea that the flu virus that she caught happened to be from the past anyway. And so the contempts, as they call them in the book, would have already been immune to it. It would have gone through them. It would have been endemic.
Wow.
Now, I was actually thinking at one point, because she was pretty sick for a while, but I didn't feel like she was really near death. Although that you mentioned some parts of the book are a little bit of a slog, and the part when she is a little confused was a little slow going for
me.
But that's kind of by its nature, right? Where she's confused, and so the reader is a little confused. But I was thinking that somehow she had gotten ill, and then her illness had somehow gotten into the dig site and mutated, and then that was what they ended up with in the future, even further mutated and worse. But I don't think, I think that's needlessly complicated. I don't think that's actually what happened. I think it just happens that she was at the dig. She picked up the same bug that everybody else had.
Yeah, that makes sense.
But yeah, it didn't really matter because none of those people were going to live anyway, which is sad.
Oh my goodness. Right. And that to me is the second big breaking of the formula, is that we have a lot of plot threads that get started, like Rosamund's engagement to the terrible Sir Blowett, and the fact that Elois is having an affair, and you know, what will her husband say when he comes back and realizes? And in the end, none of it matters. None of it pans out because they all die before those conflicts have any resolution. And on the one hand, that is some Suzanne Collins' third Hunger Games book level of terrible reality ensuing. But on the other hand, I think it's brilliant.
The chickens don't ever come home to roost because they've all died. And that's sad. Well, and you know, you slowly get that revealed. And this was the big spoiler, of course, was that she had tried to go back to 1320 and ended up in 1348, right at the worst of the beginnings of the Black Death in Oxford.
Yes.
And there were clues, there were context clues that were laid that then she was able to fill back in when she realized, oh, okay, they were sent away from the husband, and the husband was supposed to be joining them, but he sent them out of Bath in order to get them away from an outbreak that was already in progress there.
That's right.
So, yeah. There are so many named characters in this book that die that it's kind of shocking. I thought, well, okay, several of these people are actually going to live because Kivrin was there, and that was always kind of part of the timeline.
Right.
But like you said, then that would probably result in some slippage and she wouldn't be able to go there.
Ooh, that is dark. What an uncaring universe this has been painted as.
Yeah. At some point, we'll have to talk about the future timeline part of it, but I do want to continue on the plague part of it. The Kivrin is a great character. I really enjoyed
her.
Connie Willis writes characters really, really well. And she is coming to the idea of a plague with a more contemporary view of things, right? Where everybody there is seeing it as a judgment from God, right? And you have especially the character Hermione, which sounds like Hermione actually in the audiobook almost. And I was struck by really on both sides of the plague in the current time and the plague in the past by the kind of types of people that there are, right? There's the person who's just looking for somebody to blame, and there's the people who are just, what can I do to help? And Hermione, of course, vacillates from it's Kivrin's fault, it's Eloise's fault, it's Gawain's fault, it's Father Roche's fault, you know, even though, of course, she is the one who invited the bishop there, or the bishop's clerk anyway, and brought the plague to them, right? But she's not going to blame herself.
Right. And what you're bringing up with Hermione.
Hermione is the way the audiobook says it.
Yeah. What you bring in with Hermione and the bishop's clerk is sort of central to what I think are the main messages of this book. And the first is that suffering is the universal element of humanization.
Yeah.
Kivrin had looked at the bishop's clerk as just the worst humanity has to offer in terms of lechery and ungratefulness and just adding no value. But she cares for him as well as she would Agnes or anybody else that she cares for, because she can see the suffering that he's in. And so I think it was fascinating to see the way that suffering acted as a sort of universal, empathetic doorway to this. And the way that the lady of the house reacts, it makes me think that in some ways, faith is primarily about what it brings out in the person itself, not so much the person's relationship with what they believe, but how they then go on to treat others. And so
yes.
If for a lot of these characters, in their final moments, in their final days of suffering, their faith causes them to, either continue as they were or express more gratitude than usual. But for her, as you say, she turns paranoid. She begins accusing everyone around her. And it shows mm-hmm. that the type of faith she possessed was not one which enabled her to have healthy relationships with those around her, but in fact sort of poisoned right. herself as well as those in her vicinity.
Yeah, and she's so dead set against Father Roche, who is such a noble character, right? Where
yes.
there's one point where she's complaining about Father Roche, and Kivrin is thinking, well, this worthless priest you're talking about is on his knees in the cold chapel right now, you yes. know, preparing for all the holiday festivals and everything. He's doing all the little things that need to be done for everything to go properly. And he's doing it out of a sincere and pious faith, which is very, very much contrasted with hers.
What did you make of the long belief of Kivrin's that Father Roche was the cutthroat character she kept imagining?
I mean, part of that was, right, they established quite well that one of the initial symptoms of that, of the flu that they had, or the influenza that they had, I guess, was delirium. And I think it was probably just she came through and was not in the right state of mind to be able to recognize what a healthy person looked like in the 14th century, right? And I'm sure that, you know, his teeth weren't fantastic and he was rough around the edges and probably didn't smell very good.
Yes.
So, and also there's something there about, I think, the way he looked at her. Because when you find out ultimately, which I didn't think was that big of a twist. I had picked up on it already that he had probably seen her come through, and that's why he had such high regard for her, because he thought she was an angel. But I think she could have misinterpreted some of the ways he kind of side-eyed her sometimes, and maybe particularly at the beginning.
Since you bring up the concept of how dirty and unhygienic all these people are, I wanted to shout out this particular passage from page 200. Eloise, Imione, and Rosamond have comparatively clean faces, but they don't wash their hands even after emptying the chamber pot, and the idea of washing the dishes or changing the flock and the mattresses had yet to be invented. By rights, the lot should have long since died of infection, but except for scurvy and a lot of bad teeth, everybody seemed to be in good health. So I ran this past my medievalist husband, and he feels like this is slightly exaggerated slander against the Middle Ages. But I'm sure that Ms. Willis did a lot of research to determine how she wanted to depict this.
Yeah. I mean, the notion that, people like bathed once a year, that kind of thing. There is some evidence for that, but may not be 100%. You know, you can paint with a broad brush with that kind of thing.
Well, the way that she described the Middle Ages, would you want to live there?
No, not really. I'm a quite a fastidious person. Not when it comes to like organization, but I'm a daily shower person.
Yes.
So, and I'm a little germ phobic as well.
I wanted to quickly share, I made a list of the things that go wrong immediately after Kivrin arrives in the past.
Yeah, go for it.
Just in classic tradition of acknowledging how often characters who engage in time travel think that they have everything planned out and really don't. She arrives already sick. There was a scare that she would be spreading illness to others. She tosses away the Isabelle de Beauvrier false name and identity they had identified for her. That got lost immediately. She gets lost in the forest. As a woman, she quickly realizes that she cannot go to the drop zone on her own. She needs to be accompanied and needs to be shown where it is. She can't even converse with men without suspicion being thrown at her. The clothing she was given is too clean, too fashionable, too wealthy, and not warm enough. And they also realized that once she arrives in the forest, they did not have a good estimate on how large this forest would be, or where the roads would be, or the frequency of passerby. Do you remember that bit towards the beginning, they're saying, oh, there's a 95% probability of this. And it was really fascinating, is it sounds like the math and the algorithms were correct, but the historical data they were operating on was recorded incorrectly or was false. And I think that's an issue that still exists in contemporary use of algorithms, is the math is correct, but sometimes the data we feed into it is already biased or already incorrect in a way that simply exacerbates the problem on the large scale.
Sure. Yeah. And that's why we're always refining models and trying to get better data, right? You didn't mention the other thing that went wrong was she was just sent to the wrong time.
Because
Badri was already disoriented from the illness, or I suppose to be British about it, disorientated.
Yes, very good.
Let's talk a little bit about the present day stuff, because Dunworthy is another good character. You can see how much he cares for Kivrin. She's kind of almost a surrogate daughter for him, you know, as a student. There's nothing creepy in it, though, which I really liked.
Mm, yes.
And here in the present time as well, you have that divide between the people who are just looking for someone to blame, and that's Gilchrist, because he immediately, even though he's the one who rushed the drop, who didn't do all the proper prep work, he is immediately saying, well, Badri was clearly on drugs, and that happened on your watch. It's your fault, you know. And you do see this a lot, unfortunately. We saw a lot of it during the pandemic, trying to blame other people.
That's right.
Instead of just saying, well, what's the thing that we can do to help?
That's absolutely right. And so many things in the present day sections of this novel really rang home. The rapid stockpiling and then diminishing of stockpiles of types of food. Of toilet paper. Yes, that one was very, very specific. And then towards the end, they were running out of medical supplies, running out of fresh face masks.
Mm-hmm.
It was very distressing reading those sections, I would say.
Yeah. Well, like when there's the American handbell choir, I guess.
They
said bell ring, or she said bell ringers, but I'm assuming it was a handbell choir.
Yeah.
Where one of them early on says, well, in America, nobody would ever infringe on my civil liberties and keep me from going where I want to go. I'm like, wow, that's
spot that's
right on the mark.
Yes.
Yeah.
I thought a very interesting aspect of this is that they're initially calling it the South Carolina virus. And then they realize belatedly, oh, it actually came from Oxford. And so even today, we still face the awkwardness of if you name a virus after a place, sometimes you're going to deal with the fact that you might not have been right the first time around.
Right.
For instance, I had it pointed out to me
even
recently.
Before then, they called it the Indian flu.
Right. Right.
And so, you know, there were pamphlets being circulated calling for Britain to leave the European economic community because of foreign viruses being spread by brown people.
Oh, my gosh. How prescient. I actually put that quote down here to read this. A vote for secession is a vote for health. Committee for an Independent Great Britain. This was written in 1992, and she nailed it. She knew it was coming. So just once again, for readers at home, if you are looking for an escapist fantasy that will not remind you of current times, this might not be the book for you.
No, definitely not. And it's funny because I'm of two minds about it, where I was telling my wife about it. I'm like, I love that book. I thought it was really, really good. I'm not sure who to recommend it to right now.
Yes. Well, okay. I think we need to talk about one thing, which is I think this book takes place over the course of maybe 2 weeks, because my understanding is that Kivrin leaves December 23rd, somewhere around there, and comes back around January 6th. And in that time, the virus is identified, a vaccine is produced, a vaccine is distributed, and the quarantine is lifted. I have to say, what is this beautiful utopian fantasy that Connie Wills has painted in which the whole thing blows over in 2 weeks? And why are we not there yet, Seth?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was more like 3 weeks because Dunworthy falls ill right at the point that they were going to do the pickup, right?
That's a good point.
And so he's down for several days with it. But if we produced a vaccine in 2 weeks, can you imagine the reaction on social media about how there'd be microchips in it so Bill Gates could track you and it changes your DNA?
Yeah. And even today, when it comes to the distribution of the thing, we're getting emails from the institution we're affiliated with here saying, all right, we've gone through 1A, we're currently on distribution 1B, 1C is TBD. And we're thinking, oh, no, that means they have no plan. This is a beautiful future vision of an Earth which is organized, scientifically advanced enough, and socially advanced enough to get all these things out right away.
Right. Well, another parallel, too, is Gilchrist at some point locks down the laboratory.
Yeah.
Because he's done research on Facebook and decided that the virus came from the net. Through nothing scientific, he decides, I'm gonna shut down the lab.
So. Yes.
Mrs. Gadsden is another one of those people who I feel like she thinks she's helping. But going around and reading people the curses from Deuteronomy from the Bible. I don't understand what the idea was there. That was
Oh my goodness.
And complaining about her her terribly fragile and innocent son William, who's this Lothario.
All right. I'm trying to decide if I'm okay with William as a character or not, because on the one hand, much needed levity. On the other hand, he's that person who will never wear a mask and will go around consorting with all the sort of people who are going to spread it further. In addition, yes, there are probably...
And will never get sick.
Close to a dozen times that he is discovered with a woman in the course of his book. Okay. I guess I'm glad William's in this.
Mm-hmm. There were some moments of levity, right, from William and from the repeated complaining about the carillon in Carfax Tower, which I guess is like a automated bell ringing kind of thing, where it would constantly be talking about whatever Christmas carol it was currently slaughtering.
I did want to bring up the recurring symbol of the bells. And I went back today and noticed that the first inscription of the book itself is about the bells and the need for them to continually be rung on a schedule. And so I was trying to think about all the different things they might represent. And I think, of course, on the one hand, they're an annoyance to Mr. Dunworthy, this thing that does not matter in the larger scope. But it also becomes a sort of ritual, a sort of constant presence in his life that I think is comforting in some ways. And I really liked the times that Kivrin would be in the past and she can hear the far off bells of distant other villages that are maybe 10, 15 miles away. And I liked that because the place where she is, she's so confined to this one town that it can feel like an island. And just hearing those other bells reassures you, you are not alone. Mm-hmm. So I thought the recurring image of those was very lovely.
Yeah. I wondered when she described the kind of cacophony of bells where it started to be, the bells were ringing so much that it was confusing where they were coming from. Yeah. And I was wondering if she was hearing the bells come through from the drop.
Ooh.
At that point, and just assuming that it was from somewhere else. But because you find out very late in the book that Badri had tried opening the net.
Oh, that's a very nice thought. Good catch. Yeah. I like that idea. What do you think about the fact that there's not really any romantic plot lines? Were you okay with that?
I love it.
Yep, me too.
Yeah. I mean, there is a romantic subplot in To Say Nothing of the Dog, and I love that one as well. So I'm not against it, but I like the fact that you had, you know, you didn't have to have, you know, an embrace of Kivrin and Father Roche, you know, at any point. Even though, you know, when he's confessing that he had carnal thoughts about a saint, you know who he's talking about.
Yes, you do.
But I was quite pleased with that. And it would have been a weird juxtaposition of that with the horrifying betrothal of Rosamund to whatever his name was.
Agreed.
Yeah. The old guy with no teeth who just wanted a younger womb to try and put some babies in.
Oh. And as you brought up earlier, what this book is really working towards in terms of relationships is sort of the father-daughter dynamic of Kivrin and Dunworthy.
Yeah.
And I think it's really beautifully handled, and it's exactly what the book needs right at the end.
Yeah, and you mentioned as well, Colin is quite delightful.
Oh.
And the kind of Batman and Robin thing there, where the death that hit me the hardest in this was
Mary.
His great aunt Mary.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, that's a shame.
It was.
And then, you know, the fact is that everybody in 1348 dies as well, and that was tough.
Yes. I remember sitting in the teacher's lounge reading this little portion. One of my favorite scenes from this is the Christmas Mass. Mm-hmm. It just seems like, despite all the other things that have gone so poorly, this was one beautiful, cherished moment for them. And so Kivrin is reflecting with Agnes in her lap. She could never in 100 years, in 734 years, have imagined Agnes with her puppy and her naughty tantrums and her infected knee. I'm glad I came, she thought, in spite of everything. And I remember commenting on how lovely this was, because I had read it just before Christmas as well. And the woman who recommended the book to me was like, oh, better break out the tissues, because that's the last happy memory. So I cherish that scene even more now, knowing what comes next.
Yeah. Well, there's some interesting meditations, too, on faith in there, right? Where Kivrin is a person who doesn't seem to have a ton of faith anyway. And there's some – the book mentions there's the New Reformed Church, I think they call it, which is kind of a ecumenical thing where it seems like they have little bits of several churches in it.
Yeah.
But she's very angry and she is sort of pleading, right? Don't do this to him. Not even the clerk who seemed to be not a very good person, but he didn't deserve this kind of suffering. And then certainly Roche, who gave him of himself so selflessly, then ends up, you know, in this horrifying way to go as well. And you can definitely, I as a person of faith myself, I can totally understand. I have a friend who recently just passed away, and it's hard to square sometimes.
Yeah. And I think what that speaks to really well in terms of the contemporary message this book sends is, I think what a lot of people are struggling with is the feeling of being alone or feeling of not knowing the meaning behind some of the events that are happening. And I think that's what this book tries to address, is how we rebuild, reconstruct our own faith and our own understanding of how we reconcile with the things that cannot be understood sometimes from the human perspective.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, Kivrin made a difference, even though she didn't save any lives. She still did make a difference in the way it all went down.
I agree.
And they show that, Connie Willis shows that by having Dunworthy and Colin ride through another village where she wasn't, where she and Roche were not there doing what they did, and seeing how much worse it really could be.
That's a really great point. And it seems like a refutation of the way the net works, where it claims, you know, we will send this person to a time where they can't impact history. And you're saying that it's not just laws which are passed and wars which are started that count. Mm-hmm. It's the small human connections, the small human dignities that are afforded to people who would never see them otherwise.
Yeah. I think I have come to the end of my notes, but happy to keep on going.
I think I've got pretty much everything here as well. Oh, I think there's one more thing we should talk about, which is all centuries are a 10.
Right.
It seems to me that one of the messages of this book, in Willis saying every century is a 10, is that the things we think we're prepared for, we aren't at all.
Right.
Look at how many people Budgery interacted with while he was asymptomatic but contagious. And you'll see that the way we have set up society is so that a pandemic could absolutely rip through with ease. And I don't want to blame us, because we're trying to live as best we can, but it's true that we're living in a way that does not keep us safe from a threat like this. In some ways, I thought a little bit about how society changed after 9/11 and the way that airport security has changed permanently since then. And I start thinking about whether some of the things we do in society might change permanently as a result of COVID. Maybe hand sanitizer will be ubiquitous. Maybe anybody who's sick has to wear a mask wherever they go. I don't know. I can't help but wonder, because this example in 2055 was such an accurate depiction of how quickly something can spread, how quickly a situation can get out of hand. And we might think that we're doing great compared to the past. And you know what? We're not all that much more prepared than people were hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. Well, and even in the 2055 of the book, they'd had a relatively recent pandemic as well. And so they were more prepared than you'd think we probably were for COVID.
Yeah.
So, and it still went pretty badly.
Whew. Yeah.
I mean, that's a good point about the idea of every century being a 10. It's kind of the risk factor of going to it, right? And there's an authorization process that takes place to allow a drop to a particular area. And there's also the other side of that is, it's really easy to think back to, like, when I was a kid. You know, I was a kid in the late 70s, early 80s, and think about how much better things were, because we didn't have cell phones and we just told our parents, hey, we'll be back at dinner time, and hopped on our bikes, and they had no idea where we went. You know, some kids did that and never came home. And the fact that we did, well, we're lucky that we did. And also, you know, if you want to think about, oh, things were so much better in my grandparents' time. Well, yeah, they might have been better for your grandparents, but not for everybody in society. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe people who didn't look like your grandparents had a harder time. And it's really tempting to lionize the past.
Yeah.
When in fact, there was messed up stuff in every decade.
And maybe to spin it in a positive light as well, maybe on the flip side, the message of the book is also that every century is a 10 in terms of the positive experiences you can have, in terms of the beautiful connections you can make and the wonder and beauty in the world that you can discover. I feel like that is a part of Kivrin's experience as well.
Yeah, and you can, regardless of what situation in, you can be the person who blames everybody, like Gilchrist and Hermione, or you can be the person who hangs around being unhelpful, like Mrs. Gadsden. Yeah. Or Gallstone, I guess. Isn't that what Colin called her?
or let's not let a Bazingame, the head of history who's fishing in Scotland for the entire book, get away. He probably had the best experience out of anybody in this book.
Right. Definitely, yeah. But yeah, or you can be like people like Dunworthy and Colin and Kivrin and Father Roche, you know, Colin sneaking around, get around the stupid regulations to try and positively affect what's going on. In spite of the fact that he lost his great aunt, he still was caring for Mr. Dunworthy. That was really sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, final thoughts on this book?
I would recommend this to people. It is something that I think we have cautioned people against if they have certain things they're not looking for. Oh, you must also have a good stomach for handling gore and illness to some degree.
Right. Yeah.
Otherwise, I think this is definitely a worthy inclusion on the Hugo's list. And I'm really glad that we got to read it in this very interesting time, almost precisely 1 year after COVID was identified. What a gift that so much of science fiction can speak to the present condition, despite the fact that this book takes place in the past and the future and not in our time itself.
Yes. Yeah. Very good. You mentioned at some point that there are a few spots where, you know, the book is on my device. It said it was 568 pages or something. And in a book that long, you can expect there to be some sloggy portions. And I can say that, you know, I read the last 130 pages last night with very little effort. It was very, very good prose, very easy to read, good narrative greed to it. But there are some slower spots. Do you want to call out any of those?
I think just the fact that there are sometimes that people have a specific goal they're working towards for 200 or 300 pages, and then it doesn't pay off. Kivrin trying to get back to the drop, and then she can't find it. Or, things of that nature. Trying to track down Gawain, and he's just too elusive and unhelpful.
Yes. Yeah.
So I think she did that purposefully.
Yeah.
But that can feel like a while. And as you said as well, when she's very ill, or when you're waiting for Budgery to be conscious enough that he can give Mr. Dunworthy valid information. Ooh, that takes a while to happen.
It does. Yeah. And I'm sure it's especially frustrating for them as well, where Budry remembers that he had given this information, but he wasn't lucid at the time. And then at some point, then Dunworthy's out of it when Budry comes and tells him, hey, I'm opening the drop.
Yeah.
That's the way it goes in plagues sometimes.
Yes, it is.
Well, I really enjoyed this one. And like you said, know yourself. If this kind of book is going to cause you to
undue distress.
I don't know. Yeah. If in this time, this may not be the book for you, I encourage you to, you know, bump it down the road a year or something and come back to it. Cause it is worth reading. And if you want other Connie Willis, I will hardly recommend To Say Nothing of the Dog, because that one it's one of my favorites that I've read for the Hugos. Much more light reading, but it's still like 500 pages long. So.
Well, that'll have to be on my list from now on.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, I really want to thank you for doing this. I think you've been a tremendous guest, and thank you for finding the contact form and reaching out.
Thank you so much for making it available, Seth. I hope that you have a wonderful experience with all of your other reading, and I hope that Hyperion stays at number 2 on your list.
Okay. I don't think there's a lot of danger of that one coming down, just because I have such high regard for that one. I actually want to reread it, because I have The Fall of Hyperion that I'd like to read at some point. It's hard to fit in extra reading. So we'll see. All right. Well, thanks again. This was a ton of fun. It was really great to meet you.
Thanks so much for having me, Seth. Take care.
You too. Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Rebecca. She thanked me for allowing non-podcasters to participate. And I want to reemphasize that there really isn't a barrier for entry here other than the requirement that you bring your passion and knowledge and thoughts on the title you choose. And on that note, I do want to let you know that I'm starting to get down to the end of my guest list. So last time that I'd put out a request for guests. My audience more than answered the call, so I'm going to do it again. New guests, return guests, whatever, drop me a line, feedback@hugospodcast.com, or fill out the contact form, or reach out to me on Twitter @hugospodcast. I would love to hear from you. I also want to let you know, if you're not aware, that Hugo nominations are now open. So if you are a Worldcon member and you feel like this podcast is worthy of nomination, I'd be thrilled if you nominated it. I've already got a list myself of podcasts and fanzines and movies and TV that I'll be nominating, and I am hoping to read at least some short fiction to nominate, since my full-length novel reading is generally not right up to date. I literally don't think I read a novel published in 2020. And with that, I think I'll sign off. So thank you so much for listening. And like I said, feel free to reach out to me to book a guest spot or just to say hello. Love to hear from you, no matter what. So I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.